This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. More than 200,000 students attend classes at one of the 17 institutions that make up the UNC system. Funding for these schools has decreased significantly in the last few years. Tom Ross is president of the University of North Carolina system, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you very much, Frank. I'm delighted to be with you.
The UNC system has enjoyed a great deal of support from the legislature in the past, but those days seem to be over now. The last budget was reduced by $115 million. How do you make the case to elected representatives that UNC is vital? They all say it's vital, but it keeps going down. How do you make the case that it really is vital, or is it?
Well, I think it is vital to North Carolina. I think the history of the state shows that it's incredibly important to our state. The university, in many ways, is an economic engine for North Carolina, and it's the producer of talent. You know, we are the place where 70% of the degrees are produced in North Carolina, and so that's the talent pool for our businesses and for communities, community leaders, government. So I definitely think the university is vital to our future. And I think that, you know, what's happened in the last 4 or 5 years is obviously we've had a tough economy. And so state government had a huge deficit a couple of 3 years ago, and everybody suffered significant cuts. And I think it's too early to tell whether this is a trend that's going to last for a long time or whether it's still sort of temporary based on the economy. When I look at national trends, however, it is concerning that state support generally across the country has declined in higher education. North Carolina is still ahead of the curve in that regard, in that we still receive more funding on a per-student basis than many states. And that's really important for a lot of reasons, one of which is it allows us to keep our tuition much lower than many states. Because what you have to look at is all the different funding sources. So if you have higher state support, then you can charge less tuition, which means our students have less debt. They're better able to pursue their dreams without regard to that debt. And all that's very important, I think, for the state. So we have to continue to make our case that the university is important for lots of reasons and hope that things turn around in the future.
Well, you know, the economy is turning around in general, and I've seen estimates that state revenue could go up by 3.6%. Other states are now turning around to reflect that, and funding there is at a higher level, not a lower level. And I've seen, you know, criticisms that this legislature has basically declared war on higher education. How do you feel about that?
Well, I hope that's not true, and I don't think that it is, but I do worry about the competition. I say often that the competition in the world of the economy today is not about the best technology. It's not about the best machines. It's not about the best facilities. It's more than anything else about talent and who's going to be able to have the talent to supply the business needs of the future. And there's a lot of evidence that we're going to have to increase educational attainment in this state and in this country if we're going to meet the demand for our talent pool in the future. And when I look at what other states are doing, this past year, 13 out of 16 states in the Southeast increased funding for higher education. We were only one of three states, along with Louisiana and West Virginia, where there was a cut in higher education funding. But then I see what's happening in a state like Connecticut, where they appropriated $137 million in new funding for the University of Connecticut, primarily focused on hiring new faculty. And in addition to that, approved nearly $1 billion in bonding authority for the university to be able to build new facilities. When asked about that, the president of the University of Connecticut said that her dream was to make Connecticut like the Research Triangle Park, because the place where business and education come together to drive an economy. That's what they want to be. And how are they going to do it? She says they're going to go find the best faculty in America and bring them to Connecticut. And they've already stolen two of our faculty from UNC Chapel Hill. So that's the competition we're facing, and we got to worry about that, and we got to think about how are we going
to
handle that.
So she's getting the money to realize her dream, and I'm guessing your dream is not to be compared with Louisiana or West Virginia ever again.
Well,
but let me ask you this though, because there's a way in which the argument about competition, if we're the driving force in the economic engine, you know, Governor McCrory has suggested not driving fast enough. That what this education system has to do is retool and make sure that we have jobs for everybody coming out. A clear suggestion that a kind of liberal arts education, a more broad education, may not be the way we should be focusing our higher education system. What do you think?
Well, I think if you look at the data, what you would see right through the heart of the recession is that the unemployment rate for people with a bachelor's degree or higher barely ever got higher than 5%. For most all of the recession, it was under 5%. So clearly people who have a higher education, who have a bachelor's degree or higher, are very employable. Now, so the question becomes, well, how are they employed? Are they employed in a job that's related to their major? Are they underemployed in the sense that maybe they're not in a job that requires a college degree? There's some of that for sure, but there's always some of that when you're in the middle of a recession. I think if you look at the data around what CEOs say they want for their employees, what you will find is that they will tell you, and there was a survey recently of the top 300 CEOs in America, and what they said was, we want people who know how to think, who can communicate well both in writing and orally, who have digital literacy and who understand information technology and who understand how to use data to solve problems. That's what our students graduate with, whether they have degrees in the humanities or social sciences or whether they have a hard science degree. There's never been a direct line between most college majors and a job. And yet, throughout our history, these folks find their way into all sorts of different jobs that are key to our economy. So, you know, we have liberal arts graduates that are in the financial industry and doing very well. We have them that are CEOs and that are in government and that are leaders in lots of different fields. And so I think we have to continue to produce the kind of workers that have the competencies that business needs. And that's really what we need to focus upon.
Your answer is compelling, but it suggests that we already have that system in place. Clearly what the governor was saying is he's not happy with the way things are working out, that he wants to tie funding to a different kind of outcomes, different kind of metrics. The clear suggestion is something has to change, and it has to do with getting jobs almost immediately out of college. What change would that be? I mean, do you agree that there's something wrong, that there's something wrong with the system now?
Well, I think we need to help students understand where the future jobs are going to be. We need to be more transparent with them about pathways into jobs and into careers, because clearly there are certain areas that we can look in the future and say, this is where there's going to be demand. There's going to be demand in healthcare jobs. There's going to be demand in advanced manufacturing. There's going to be demand in a number of different fields, technology and others. And our students deserve to know that, so that when they're planning their college experience, they can think through what is the best pathway for me. But you also, you know, people thrive when they find their passion and when that leads them in a direction where they're going to be most successful. So when students ask me, what should I major in? I always tell them, find something about which you really are passionate, because you'll be more successful at that. And when you have your college degree, if you've done well, employment will find its way to you. And I think that's generally been true in America. And if the projections are right about the need for talent in the future, we're not going to have enough college graduates. And so I think people will be plenty employable.
UNC Greensboro just announced yesterday they're going to have to cut 59 full-time positions. Last week, Elizabeth City State University announced a layoff of 46 to try to make up for their $5 million budget shortfall. NCA&T in August said they're going to have to cut about 50 jobs. And I guess ECSU wants to do what several other schools in the UNC system want to do. They want to admit a higher percentage of out-of-state students, current cap at 19%. If you increase that, obviously increase revenue, why not raise the cap?
Well, I think there are a couple things to understand. And one of them is that we don't necessarily recognize a lot of additional revenue from out-of-state students, because our funding is based on enrollment, and we only receive enrollment generally for the in-state students. And so what we charge out-of-state students is as close as we can get to what the full cost of an education is. But we also have to stay within the market for our peer groups if we're going to attract those students. We only have a few institutions that bump up against our cap right now. So raising the cap for some of the institutions really wouldn't change the dynamics of the campus very much. We did ask our board to think about raising the cap for some of our HBCUs that are up against the cap, A&T and Elizabeth City, because we think it will help them attract more students and perhaps increase the academic profile of their campuses. So that's certainly something we're looking at. I think the concern that we had coming out of the last legislative session about out-of-state students was the legislatively imposed increase in out-of-state tuition. Out-of-state students, when they come to North Carolina, our data shows about half of them stay here, and they're involved in the workforce. And that's part of the talent we need. We're counting on that talent if we're going to supply the needs of our businesses. And so, we want to stay competitive with our tuition, our out-of-state tuition. We want to charge enough to cover the full cost, but we want to be sure that we are competitive. And so that enforced 12% increase for some of our campuses, we're afraid will make us less competitive. We'll have a harder time attracting students. The quality of what we get will go down. And over time, that really will hurt our businesses.
Are HBCUs disproportionately affected by these budget cuts?
I don't know disproportionately, but they are severely impacted by them. And I think part of what's happened with the UNC system is I think we correctly decided about 5 years ago to increase admission standards because we wanted to admit students that had a real chance of success. As that happened, we knew that some of our institutions would see a decline in enrollment. And actually, there was a period of time in which the legislature held those institutions harmless from their drop in enrollment. They let them keep the money that they would have had their enrollment not dropped, and that was important. That stopped a couple of years ago, and so as enrollment has continued to drop at some institutions, that really has affected their bottom line in a significant way. And then when you put the budget cuts on top of that, it is definitely affecting those institutions. And it's part of it's a budget cut in 1 year, but part of it's the cumulative effect as you look back over 5 years, not just of the permanent cuts we've received, but what we call the reversions. That is, we're generally allowed to carry forward about 2.5% of our funds if we can save it during the year. But in the past 4 or 5 years, generally that's been swept away by the government to meet shortfalls. And so we've lost that in addition. That's been well over $1 billion in our system that we've lost. So these cuts are now at a point where we don't have any room left in many of our campuses. And so you're seeing almost all the cuts having to be made up out of personnel reductions.
Well, let's talk about the effects of those, not just on HBCUs, but the cumulative effect of those cuts just up to date, whether or not they go forward. What is the impact on the system?
Well, I mean, we've seen in real dollars, our budget today is about $150 million less than it was 5 years ago. In terms of every dollar we get, it's still about a 5.7% reduction over the last 5 years. At the same time, we've added over 11,000 students. So the budget has dropped significantly while the number of students has gone up. Now, what that's done is force us to be more efficient, and we are. We are producing 17% more degrees than we were 5 years ago, and we're doing it, if you adjust for inflation, at 17% less costs. So less costs, more degrees. We're definitely more efficient. I think our concern is going into the future, at what point does efficiency begin to affect excellence? And that's the balance we've got to find in North Carolina. We want to be more efficient.
Well, has it all
been
efficiencies?
But not to lose excellence.
Have we lost some excellence? Has there been some quality that has gone out because
well,
of
I think that's debatable. You know, it's certainly we have in many institutions larger class sizes. You know, we are fewer course offerings. We've had to shut down some programs. So you could argue that that does affect, affect the opportunities of some of our students. But it's also forced us to do some things better. So, for example, we've got a foreign language consortium that we're doing to offer more languages to more students across campuses using technology. So I think there's some things we've done better to increase opportunities. We're trying to enhance our online opportunities for students. That's not free, by the way. A lot of people think online's the savior of all things because it'll be less expensive. It's really not, because the technology is extremely expensive to do it well. But I think we can adjust and keep some of the opportunities for students using those kinds of tools without affecting excellence. And so, but we're getting close to the point where I think we're seeing some erosion of quality.
Well, what about faculty retention? You talked about losing a couple to Connecticut. Other universities have poached from the system. How do you retain the best faculty here in light of these budget issues? And again, some of the conversation, some of the talk in the air from the legislature and the governor's mansion.
I think you've put your finger on maybe the most serious problem we have right now. Our faculty is really the key to a great university. You know, high quality faculty is very, very important, and the competition for the best faculty is intense. And it's in part going after a particularly good faculty member. But what people are also figuring out is with the faculty member comes grant dollars, and those grant dollars create jobs for the state. They create stimulus to the economy. And so other states are figuring this out. And, you know, UNC Chapel Hill, for example, is a top 10 research institution in America. Our university system brings $1.2 billion of external funding into the state that creates thousands of jobs. And that's part of what's at risk if we start to lose our faculty. And we are losing them. In a typical year, at Chapel Hill, for example, if you had 100 professors that were offered a job somewhere else, we would keep about 70% of those. Last year, we only kept 33%. So it's really starting to show. And we haven't had a compensation adjustment for our faculty other than a 1.2% adjustment a couple of years ago. We haven't had any increases in 6 years for those faculty members. And so we're falling behind our neighboring states, but we're following behind universities all over the country. And so the competition, again, is really intense for the best faculty. And we've got to address this issue of compensation for our faculty, much as we do for public school teachers, if we're going to be successful in keeping the best.
Well, that may be part of it. And then there do seem to be these kind of ideological questions that are hanging in the air. And maybe another way to reflect that is the Board of Governors that voted to ban gender-neutral housing at UNC Chapel Hill after the Board of Trustees permitted it. Tell us about that, about the Board of Governors sort of micromanaging, in a sense.
Well, I think, you know, the board felt that was the right decision for the university, and that there were other alternatives to address the concerns. And I think there was some concern that the legislature might get in the business of micromanaging maybe more than it should, and the board felt like it needed to protect against that. I think that the question of what's going on in the state generally, you know, clearly people who are thinking about moving to any state, they take those things into account. What's the climate of the state? What's the, you know, the attractiveness of the schools? What's the environment look like? All those things are factors that people, businesses take that into account. So do individuals. And so, you know, I don't know of situations where we've lost faculty because of this, but I think, you know, certainly that you hear people talking about it.
Well, sir, if you go from 70 to 33% retention, salary is probably a very big part of it. But I'm just wondering,
yeah,
kind of what else?
Yeah, it's hard to know what all the factors are. But, you know, people make decisions for lots of reasons, as you point out. And some of it is compensation, but some of it's, you know, where they feel comfortable and what's going on in the state. And so I'm sure all this is playing into people's decisions.
On the State of Things today, we are talking with UNC System President Tom Ross, a conversation that will continue in a moment. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Tom Ross, president of the UNC system. Just before the break, talking about the decision by the Board of Governors not to allow gender-neutral housing, a big controversy around that. And the issue, especially for the LGBT community, was one of safety. Their concern that that their safety could not be ensured as well under those circumstances. Safety on campus is a big issue, and the number of sexual assaults, not necessarily at UNC, but generally on college campuses, is alarming. What's being done to address safety on the campus?
Well, let me start by saying that, you know, when you look at the data on our college campuses, they are safer than the communities around them normally. And you would expect that because the college campuses are made up of young people and students and faculty that are focused on education. And so the number of crimes committed are far fewer on a college campus than they are in our normal communities. So it's not a runaway crisis, but it is a problem. And it's a problem that has, I think, lots of dimensions to it. And what we've done is create a new campus security task force that's made up of chancellors, public safety officers, counselors, student affairs groups, a number of different campus officials to look at what we're doing. We want to do a couple of things. One of them is to be sure that the processes that we have in place to handle these kinds of cases is the right one. So when it's a serious violent crime, you have to worry about what are the implications for the criminal justice system. And you want to have a process that doesn't interfere with that, but also both protects the victim and the accused in our own disciplinary procedures. So we're looking at that. We also want to be sure that our campus police officers are well-trained, that they have the resources they need to do their job. We've seen incidents just recently here in Durham where our law enforcement officers had to step up and deal with a criminal. Sad outcome, but it was handled very well by our law enforcement officers because they've been very well-trained. And that's a critical piece of it. And we don't always get the resources we need. So that's going to be some of what we look at. And then finally, I think we want to be sure that we are as transparent as both the law requires, but also that we can be about what's happening on our campuses, because we want students and faculty and staff to know that they're in a safe environment. And one of the ways you do that is you're very transparent about what happens and you report everything accurately and correctly and timely. And so we want to focus on that to be sure we're doing that. We'll develop some best practices as a result of this for our campuses, but we also may change some policies. We'll see how it develops.
Well, a few months ago, the legislature passed a law allowing students to retain an attorney for university judicial proceedings. That makes this really one of the first states in the country to do that. And I wonder, as a former judge and now the UNC system president, how do you feel about students having lawyers on campus?
Well, I think we're going to have to see how that plays out. You know, I think there will be some costs that go with that. You know, there are a lot of questions that are still unanswered about that process. Part of the reason we want to look at this security task force is to be sure that the processes that are designed take into account this new law, and that we figure out how to make it work effectively if we're going to have it, but also do it in a way that reduces the cost to us, because there will be some additional costs. I think one of our main concerns is that it could end up delaying the process for disciplinary proceedings of our students. And, you know, that's something that we want to be able to deal with in an efficient way. And so we'll see how it plays out. We've been asked to keep statistics about how often attorneys are used, what the costs are, and those sort of things, so that we can report back to the legislature, and we'll do that.
You have an opinion about this yet? Good idea, bad idea?
Well, I think we have some concerns that it will delay the process and cost money, that it really won't be that effective. You know, when you're dealing with, as I said earlier, really serious violent crimes, those are often dealt with in the criminal justice system, and people have, of course, access to lawyers there. In our system, sometimes, you know, if it's a violent offense, then I don't really have as much concern about it. But if we're talking about every campus safety violation or every student disciplinary proceeding, it could drag things out, cost us, again, a lot of money to have enough staff to handle this. I don't know how you do it when you've got a student who can't afford a lawyer. Does that mean the university is required to hire one? I mean, there are a lot of unanswered questions. So we have some concerns, but it's the law, and so we will work through it, and we will apply it and live with it as it is.
You didn't think you'd get out of here without me talking about sports, and I'm not going to ask you to pick a winner either.
Ah, okay.
Money in sports and collegiate athletics is becoming a massive problem. It is certainly a problem at UNC Chapel Hill, one you're still dealing with, and it is not alone in all of that. What has to be done?
Yeah, it's a really great question that does not have an easy answer, you know, and I think everybody is struggling for what is the right answer. I think there's some things we could do, particularly if we had the cooperation of the professional leagues, that could help. So one of the problems that schools face, and this is one where I think Chapel Hill had some problems, is sports agents coming in and tampering with athletes. And oftentimes there's nothing the school's done wrong, nothing the school can do to prevent it. It's the agents that are coming in. And so I think having strong laws that punish them, as we do in North Carolina, is one approach. Another, though, is to involve the professional leagues and have them impose sanctions on those agents if they tamper with athletes so that they lose their right to represent people. That would be a real blow financially for them, and it would, I think, keep them from tampering. near as much. So that's the kind of solution that I think we could work with the professional leagues on. I think we've got to look at how we deal with all this conference expansion and the additional travel that it causes and the pressure on students to be away from class as much.
But
Those are all real concerns.
A lot of folks will say it's the dependence of these universities, our universities, on that kind of money that really is at the essence of the problem. And if we got ourselves off the fix, there wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, except when you really analyze it, universities don't make much money on athletics.
Wait a minute.
Almost all the money goes into athletics. In other words, they're only about – they're less than a dozen programs in America that actually make a profit on athletics. Most of it goes to fund all the other sports. So you might make money on football or basketball or both, but when you apply that over all of your non-revenue sports, then you really don't make money. So what you're doing is supporting real – important opportunities for student athletes through that, but it doesn't provide funding for buildings and education of students and faculty and all those things.
Bring in other alumni money that people have.
It does. I think that's really an important part of athletics. Is that it's a? I used to hear people call it the front porch of the university. You know, it's part of what attracts people to a place, but it's also what keeps alumni loyal, and they do give resources back. A lot of it to non-athletic needs that we have. And so there's that balance that needs to be struck as well.
Tom, what a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Mine all entirely, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Tom Ross is the president of the UNC system.